says the brightest light in his life is his and his wife's 3.5-year-old son. And now I would like to welcome Greg Sando.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Dan. Dan has an 8-month-old. We were happily bonding over kids. So I hope you don't mind if I sit. It just feels more informal, though I realize maybe you don't see as much of me, but standing and orating doesn't quite feel right. I am really honored and interested to be here. I'm a very part-time academic. I mean, I've been teaching at Juilliard for 18 years, but one course each semester. I have been a visiting professor at the University of Minnesota. Anne and I have been in residence at Bowling Green in Florida State. For a couple of years, I was artist in residence at School of Music at the University of Maryland in College Park, where I was working with students trying to develop ways for them to find an audience their own age. But I'd never had a full-time academic job, so you all know a good deal more about what you face than I do, and I have expected to learn a lot at this conference, and it has happened, although I must say I didn't know, and you have to know that Italian opera is one of my great loves, but from Courtney Miller's fascinating talk on the history of the English horn, I learned that Rossini, in some of his seminal, very early works, sometimes substituted English horns for oboes. And I'm just dying to know which Italian cities didn't have English horns available, because there's got to be a story there. So I will start with background to how we can learn to survive, which is what exactly the problem is. We all know there's a classical music crisis. And an interesting question is how long this crisis has existed, which is not one I've seen often asked. Well, I've been teaching my Juilliard course on the future of classical music since 1997, so apparently there was talk of a crisis then. In 1993, the League of American Orchestras, which at the time was the American Symphony Orchestra League, came out with a report called Americanizing the American Orchestra, full of things about orchestras and their communities, which are now commonplace, but were horrifying then. And when the New York Times wrote critically of the report, they buried it, and now it's even hard to find a copy. And when I asked on my blog about when the crisis might have started, I got many, many responses, and one of them, really fabulous, from somebody who worked in marketing at the Boston Symphony and said in 1979, that's when they noticed their ticket sales were beginning to slide. It happened at the famous Friday afternoon concerts attended by wealthy women of a certain age. And in 1979, there were fewer of those people that suddenly people inside the organization sat up and took notice. Although it's really interesting that nobody talked much about a crisis until the 90s, even though stuff was going on. So what does the crisis consist of? Everybody mentions the same three things, I think: an aging audience, falling ticket sales, difficulties with funding, which over the last couple of years for orchestras and the Metropolitan Opera have been really, really, really acute and very public. And then in back of that, a larger kind of vague cloud of a thing about our decreasing relevance, which would seem maybe to be the least graspable and least tangible and quantifiable thing, but actually I think is the most important and the foundation for all the other problems. So in a little more detail, because I don't know how well understood these things really are, the question of the aging audience, I still see people saying, oh, no, 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 it's not going on. Well, I have seen studies from 1937, 1955, and one published in 66. I'm not sure exactly when it was done. And all of them point to a median age for the classical music audience or some key part of it, like people going to orchestra concerts, as young as 27 in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 1937, but generally in the low to mid 30s. And the 1966 study has a wonderful passage where it says, the predominant characteristic of the performing arts audience is that it's young, and we must now try to determine why people stop going when they get older, which is another universe from ours. The NEA has tracked the rising median age of the classical music audience from 40 years old in 1982 to 49 years old at the end of the 90s, if I remember that quite correctly. But that is misleadingly low because the people going to really key classical events like the Metropolitan Opera or major orchestras are older, according to all reports. And I won't go into now the reasons why the NEA figures would be younger. It's not that they're wrong. They're talking to different people about different things. There also are anecdotal reports, and I won't go into much about them. They're kind of wonderful. A 1923 New York Times article about Geraldine Ferrara's farewell performance at the Metropolitan Opera, swamped by her teenage girl fans who stretched banners from one side of the house to the other, celebrating her. Again, different universe. Ticket sales are a very, very tricky question because the classical music field, in what I think is an enormous lapse, doesn't keep and isn't interested in really precise statistics. So there is no number for total ticket sales to classical music performances. The NEA asks people whether they went or not. Opera America was able to give me charts for the 9 largest opera companies outside the Met, and that is steadily down since 2000. They told my wife, the Santa Fe Opera is the most successful opera company in the U.S. because it has seen the smallest decline of ticket sales. Orchestras track this stuff and then keep it secret, which I think is a great shame. They do it because they're afraid of what their donors would think if they admitted the trouble they're in. I've heard that directly from somebody who runs one of America's leading orchestras. The public must never be told. I think that's kind of shameful, and I think it's also unwise and will backfire, and has already backfired on them in many ways. But somebody once did show me a piece of paper that I was not allowed to have a copy of and not allowed to take notes of, but it showed the individual and aggregate ticket sales to core classical concerts by the 10 largest orchestras in the U.S., and from 1990 to the middle of the last decade, it just went like that. It was really striking to see. Orchestras now say they're doing better, but they're doing better because they diversified and they have many product lines, and a lot of what they do is not classical music anymore. And when you factor in the concert that Diane Reeves sang and the concert that some pop stars sang and their mariachi concert and their family concerts and putting on the Nutcracker, then their numbers are nice, but it's not because people are going to symphonic concerts. Funding is a longer story, but start with this. If the audience is aging, the donors are aging because the donors are basically the pillars of the audience. David Gockley, who runs the San Francisco Opera, told my wife that 50% of his donated funds come from 9 individuals, all of them over 70 years old. He didn't think that was a good sign for the future. A decline in ticket sales means fewer donors available and lower income coming into the organization, which then causes financial problems. Decline in subscription sales, which orchestras and opera companies report, means they have to go out and sell tickets, single tickets, which is harder and more expensive to do. Then expenses keep rising, and there's an economic principle called the cost disease, which suggests, and economists totally buy this, that organizations that don't do manufacturing don't show productivity gains the way manufacturing companies do, but nevertheless have to pay their staffs equivalent amount and invest in computers when computers come out. And the real people hit harder are higher education and healthcare. That's where it really strikes home. But it affects classical music as well. So one last thing, you hear a lot sometimes about a big gift, $40 million to the St. Louis Symphony when it was in bad trouble. And you think, oh, great, that's a helpful sign. It is not. because these gifts are often given because the organization is in trouble. By their nature, there aren't many people who can give them, and they're not likely to be repeated. So what does the organization do once they spend the money and it's not going to come in again, and they're still in trouble? Peter Gelb, when he got a gift like that at the Met, said, okay, gets us through this season. I don't know about the future. So, but the biggest area is this cultural relevance. And really, I think it's the biggest thing, and that it explains everything else. Now, I invite you to picture with me in a very sketchy way culture as it used to be, and I'll just give you one snapshot, literally photographs I've seen. Crowds at baseball games in the 1950s, men in suits and ties and hats. That is not what you're going to see if you go to Fenway Park nowadays. That, let that stand in for large changes. But back in the day, and certainly when I was growing up and into the 70s and maybe 80s, art meant the fine arts, and we took for granted that a city had to have a symphony orchestra and an opera company and a ballet company if it wanted to attract the workforce that corporations would need. And of course, the people playing in an orchestra were referred to, because this was a part maybe from the harp, correct, as the men. I, as a kid, read comics about Black Hawk, an American anti-communist hero who flew a jet plane with colleagues from other companies in the world. And I'm ashamed to tell you that I read these comics, but that was what the 50s were like. The Chinese guy in the group did not fly a plane, had buck teeth, was afraid of everything. And too horrible for words, really. A black or female president was inconceivable. And the year that Jackie Robinson became the first African-American player in the major leagues in Brooklyn, across the river at the Metropolitan Opera, somebody goes to Edward Johnson, who runs the company, and says, look at that, and look at how people love it. Shouldn't we do that? And Edward Johnson said, don't you think I have enough trouble already? And it wasn't until 1955 that they brought in Marian Anderson and changed their ways. But obviously things have changed with so much of that. And cities now, if they want to attract a workforce that will bring companies there, they want bike lanes, they want diversities, they want to make sure that there's a Whole Foods in town. And my own current hometown of Washington, D.C., just sent a go-go band to South by Southwest, go-go being D.C.'s iconic form of funk music, thinking that if people heard that, the people at the tech conference at South by Southwest would want to come and do their tech work in Washington. Nobody said, oh, we better send the National Symphony. That would not work. And to tell the story in a single snapshot, I was reading in the New York Times magazine a fascinating piece about a great controversy in biology. And I can't even remember now what it was, but there are two camps, and both led by highly distinguished people. And the camp on one side, they mentioned that the biologist in charge of the lab did most of his thinking on a skateboard, going side by side in his lab, and one of the researchers had pink hair. And you think, this is not literally my father's biologist, because he was a biologist. This is not what he and his colleagues were like. And these are not people who are going to classical music. We know this because you go to a classical music concert and you do not see people like that. So when did the cultural change begin? In the 1920s, when popular culture really rose and Gilbert Seldes became the first critic to treat it really seriously as art? Was it in the 1950s with the emergence of the Beats and rock and roll and art films and the civil rights movement? Was it the 1960s? We know what happened then, rock as an art form, sexual revolution, the women's movement, the gay movement, a great continuation of the civil rights movement, and of course beyond the 60s. But I think one change that is crucial is the diffusion of art beyond the arts. The arts, oh, I can get in such trouble for saying this. The arts are an industry, and their selling point as an industry is that they represent art and that they're the source of meaning in our culture. But that's not true anymore, because art has diffused into fashion, films, pop music in a big way, photography, graphic design, children's books. As a parent, I can tell you that those things will stand up to anything I see, the best of them. Graphic novels, street dance, which is coming into ballet, and of course, certainly ever since The Sopranos into TV, my wife and I are not the only people in the world who have watched The Wire in a state something like awe and said, this is the equal of the greatest novels we've ever read and the greatest plays we've ever seen. So where was classical music when all this change happened, and where is it now? I know, by the way, that in a lot of your schools and departments, you teach more than classical music. I am aware that changes are going on. So I'm painting with a broad brush because the issues, despite changes, still exist. But I think one of the features of classical music, and this really does persist in many quarters, is what I call its ideology, which is something not at all inherent in the music itself, but it is present in the way classical music takes shape in our world. It is sanctified. Its superiority, again, I'm talking about certain people, used to be more of them, they still exist. Its superiority unquestioned. Even my students, I find at Juilliard graduate students, even if they listen to a lot of pop music, they assume classical music is vastly superior. Along with this comes the sense of dignity and formality, concert dress, bowing to the audience, which I now think is just one of the weirdest things I see. Why are you bowing? Why don't you say hello? Even at a new music concert, the Jack Quartet bowing to its audience, it just doesn't read for me, but I understand where it comes from. The music, primarily old, despite great lip service to new music, reverence for the masterworks, worship of them, a sense that it's really crucial for a civilization to be performing as many of the Haydn symphonies as possible. Music, by the way, that I totally love and studied intently when I was writing a little entertainment symphony of my own. And there's a concept which I compare to the medieval idea of the great chain of being. At the top, the composers. This is God. And then in the middle, the performers, the musicians, especially conductors, these are the priests. And below, the people, like little birds sitting with open mouths, passively taking it in, not asked their opinion, not supposed to have an opinion, don't participate in any way. And the goal of the composer's performance is to realize the composer's intention. The meaning of music is revealed in a very important way by technical analysis, which demonstrates complexities which then go far to prove the superiority of classical music. And finally, music is a scholarly object. I saw such a great sign of that at the Metropolitan Opera at a performance some years ago of Rossini's L'Italiana in Algerie, which is as frothy a comedy as you'll ever see. Sample text from the libretto and the first act finale. In my head, there's a drum going boom, boom, boom. In my head is a hammer going knock, knock, knock. And the singers trade this off. It's not profound art. So what did the essay in the Met program book say about the opera? It was all about the new critical edition, which was really interesting. Piccolo instead of flutes, fascinating for me, but somehow not mentioned that the opera was funny. And that it was designed as entertainment. That seems to me kind of off base. And it's especially comical because from another scholarly front, they were doing the opera all wrong. Maybe they were performing in the orchestra pit, the new critical edition, but on stage they were not ornamenting the music anywhere near, not a tenth or a twentieth as much as singers would have in Rossini's time. So it seems obvious that an art form with these characteristics would have trouble adapting as our culture changed. And so in all the years while the culture was changing, classical music somehow did not participate in the Beat Generation, abstract expressionism, they listened to jazz, the civil rights movement, film noir, the psychedelic 60s, the sexual revolution, punk, and other art forms did kind of come along. So the Metropolitan Museum's Costume Institute might have a show, it is emblazoned all over the Met Museum's website, on the influence of superhero costumes on fashion. Hard to know what the New York Philharmonic's equivalent with that would be, even if they had thought of doing it. MoMA has a big Bjork show right now and has done shows which really fascinated me on the intersection of the art world and post-punk pop music in the 1980s, because I was right in the middle of that. Loved those shows. And very hard to know what classical music should do for Black History Month. I remember once when Carnegie Hall was doing some kind of African-American festival that Jesse Norman curated, the Philadelphia Orchestra's contribution was to perform Mio's Création du Monde because it has jazz in it. And I just don't think that speaks to the black community in New York City. I do not think it does. So how we do that is kind of a problem. I'm not saying that classical music didn't change, by the way. I think Berg's opera Lulu, one of my great favorites, is actually a noir work a decade ahead of its time. We have plenty of 60s music like Stockhausen's Stimmung, where singers sit in a circle in the darkness, intoning the overtones of B-flat and occasionally dropping into the proceedings the name of a god. And developments within the field, like the historical performance movement, minimalism stuff. I mean, the field has changed, but it doesn't change in a way that really makes it part of the world outside. Just a little anecdote. A girlfriend of mine, before I had met my wife years ago, when I was at Entertainment Weekly, she was approaching 40 and sort of thought, maybe I should like classical music. And she would say, can we go to a classical music concert? She forgot about that when we passed by Carnegie Hall once and the audience was leaving. She says, who are those people? She never wanted to go again. But more interestingly, one morning in my apartment, she says, oh, could you put on some classical music? So just like I'm a classical radio station, I put on some peppy Baroque music for Sunday morning. And she says after a few minutes, why isn't classical music more noir? So I said, okay, you mean like this? And I put on a recording of the Lulu Suite. And she says, not batting an eyelash at this music, which our audience has a lot of trouble with. She says, yeah, like that. Why doesn't more classical music sound like that? So we are left not really being part of the cultural conversation. I remember something Philip Glass said in an interview once, that when he was in Paris in the early 60s studying with Nadia Boulanger, we may talk as much as we like about Pierre Boulez and the importance of what he was doing there at that time, but in fact, what artistic and intellectual, cultured young Parisians were into were art films, Godard and Truffaut. And when I read that, I thought, hey, me too. Going to college, I was watching Antonioni and Fellini and Godard and Truffaut, and even though classical music was my thing, that was my contemporary art. Classical music, well, you could go to dinner parties and hear, and people are talking about the latest novel, serious literature that they're reading. They're not probably talking about any classical concerts. I have stopped conversation at dinner parties with people I didn't know simply by saying I work in classical music. You get two responses, silence or embarrassment. Oh, I don't know anything about it. I hope you don't mind. And I just want to say, you don't have to. It's really okay. We're not that superior. But it's hard to name a defining event that classical music has provided in our culture. The way Bob Dylan was in music in the 60s, or Angels in America was in theater and in the age of AIDS. And I have been reading, and maybe some of you have, about a new musical in New York called Hamilton, about Alexander Hamilton, which has been hailed rapturously by the most severe critics there are for two reasons, that it brings the sound of contemporary pop hits to the Broadway stage, and secondly, that it uses the energy of hip-hop as a metaphor for the young energy of emerging America and the American Revolution. And classical music is not offering that to people. It's happening in the theater. Kind of inconceivable that a work coming out of the classical music world would do that and be so widely successful and accepted. So for a more close-up and personal view, even though my field is classical music, a new Quentin Tarantino film is a red-letter cultural event for me more than anything I can think of happening in my own beloved field. Oh, except maybe an Italian opera performance where they really did all the ornamentation from the time, but that's just me. I imagine a graduate student or a young professor of comparative literature who loves Tarantino films is a real fan of really obscure indie bands and is a locavore in food and really seeks out unusual, obscure, small restaurants that make local cuisine. I would say that she is a very cultured person. She is an artistic person today, but she is not in the classical music audience at all. She might go to a museum now and then. She is not going to the Washington National Opera or the National Symphony. And then Richard Florida is a business consultant who wrote a book called The Rise of the Creative Class, published perhaps 15 years ago. Very, very influential, very controversial. He posited a creative class of younger people who are in the arts and technology or are interested in those things. And they are the key workforce for forward-looking employers, and their presence in a city correlates, said Richard Florida, to economic growth. They are the ones that the city of Washington, D.C. is addressing by sending a go-go band to South by Southwest. But I assign Richard Florida's chapter on their nightlife to my students at Juilliard, because he describes, from his own observation and extensive interviews, things that I can second from my own observation and people I know, that these people want to go out at night, first of all, not at 8 o'clock or at 7:30. They want to do it much more spontaneously, and they want things that are local, authentic, spontaneous, as varied as possible, very contemporary, though if they come across a production of an 18th century British play, they may just eat it up. New to them, fun, interesting, as long as it's part of the world, part of this street life. You know, like, here's the theater, here are some of their bars, here are their coffee houses, here are their art galleries, here's their nightlife, here's the theater. They go. Classical music just doesn't fit any of this, one of its problems being it's the same anywhere. Seeing one classical music concert from their point of view, you sort of have seen them all. Our claim to authenticity is our relationship to the old masterworks doesn't necessarily just radiate from the stage. So, not surprisingly, we are not on their radar, though when I taught at Eastman and I brought this up and I said, okay, students, how would you fix this? One woman says, I play the tuba. I'm going right out there and playing on the street. They've never heard anything like me before. Love that. But that's, you know, not the whole answer. So the questions about sustainability are really obvious from all of this. And so now I might ask, what will classical music look like when my 3.5-year-old son grows up? So now, I trot out my crystal ball, 2 decades in the future, can't really say, rash to try to predict. But one thing I can say for sure, and you all know this, and many of you may be part of it in one way or another, classical music is already changing and has been for a long time. But something interesting to me is that I've long known from my work inside the field that a lot of the people who run big classical music organizations really think that drastic change has to happen. Even though one of them, who used to run one of the big 5 orchestras, used to walk around the office saying in a bewildered voice, we must do something. And it never really went further than that, but he did think, we must do something. And now I find this to be very widespread and kind of public. So one of my current heroes, somebody I've known for a long time, Deborah Rutter, said something pretty remarkable, I thought. She used to run the Seattle Symphony, then was superb beyond belief as the CEO of the Chicago Symphony, and now has come to Washington to run the Kennedy Center. And when my wife asked her about Ivan Fischer, a Hungarian conductor many people loved, who refused to be music director of the National Symphony in Washington because he thought American orchestras didn't know what they were doing and just couldn't do anything aside from the straight and narrow. Deborah said, in a way, we are in a Darwinian time. Orchestras everywhere need to assess their repertoire, reach, audience, format, and role as creative and recreative artistic ensembles. We are at a critical tipping point, and those orchestras willing and able to be flexible and responsive while remaining true to standards of excellence will be the most likely to thrive. So how has she acted on that? She appointed a composer in residence, Mason Bates. You know him? He's a dance DJ as well as being a composer. His music is just full of dance beats. He's often a soloist on turntables or his laptop. He was composer in residence at the Chicago Symphony because Muti picked him, fascinatingly. Muti personally picked him as music director. Deborah got to know his work. Now she's brought him to Washington. She thinks that's the direction, one of the directions we have to move. So the nature of the change, and here, nobody's surprised at any of this. You all can't be. I mean, right in the conference program, I saw Frank Abrahams giving kind of a co-keynote address to mine, teaching music to millennials, our current pedagogy is sustainable. And when I read the abstract, I thought, well, it's exactly what I say, exactly what I think. Happy to see it happening. I know people are talking about this all over. And then there was your own report of the Task Force on the Undergraduate Music Major, Transforming Music Study from Its Foundations, a manifesto for progressive change in the undergraduate preparation of music majors. That really rocked me. I don't know if it's been received as the second coming and as the guidelines that everybody must follow, but there it is. There it is. And going back decades, the new musicology, which was quite something in its time. And now when I talk about change in classical music more generally, I can cite things I'm sure we all know about. The increasing practice of talking to the audience, which is now really not even that remarkable when it happens. Informal or anyway less formal dress at concerts. Classical musicians playing in clubs. The growth of entrepreneurship teaching at conservatories, which in Eastman and New England Conservatory, they have kind of programs with, I think, 6 full-time staff at Eastman and at least 4 at NEC with substantial budgets devoted to this, all because they know that the old careers aren't going to be there in the same way and that students must be prepared to go out on their own. A footnote to that. One of the things I love about the entrepreneurship emphasis is that it opens the door for musical creativity, even if nobody really thought along those lines at first. I'm sure some people did, but it's certainly not what you see talked about. But if the mantra becomes, be ready to go out in the world and forge your own career in your own way, obviously people think, oh, that means I can play whatever music I want in whatever way I want, because now it's up to me, and I don't have to do it through the gatekeepers. So that's kind of wonderful to see that happen. And then, you know, there are things that are kind of out there. In Hamburg, some years ago, the Philharmoniker staged a performance of Brahms II, the Brahms Second Symphony, in 50 locations around the city, each with 2 musicians at them. They were coordinated on video by their music director, Simone Young, at an iconic church tower, conducting. It's a stunt because they actually couldn't keep together and they needed a click track, a recording they'd made, which they all played to. But there it was, 10,000 people poured out to go to these 50 sites, which ranged from corporate headquarters to a concert hall to a sex club, whatever. They covered the city. So there it was. They got a lot of attention, a lot of corporate support. And then I think of Maestro, a reality show on the BBC where celebrities competed to become conductors. 2 emerged who had real talent, but they were judged by a panel of experts, including Sir Roger Norrington and, again, Simone Young. And I remember one episode in which a dance DJ had to accompany a soprano by conducting a Mozart aria and was criticized in some detail for his handling of upbeats. This was really serious about the conducting. I think you would learn more about conducting watching that than you would if PBS occasionally still broadcasts orchestras, watching a dozen of those shows. And then you have things that are really lovely. And I will take 2 from my friends at the University of Maryland School of Music. The dress code for the orchestra used to be such a wonderful thing. Everybody wore what I'm wearing now, black, but informal black. You know, no jackets, no ties, no gowns, anything you want. And then they'd pick a color for each concert and they would accessorize. You know, red for the Symphonie Fantastique, blue and green for the Mahler Fourth. And so you'd go to the concert and there they are on stage, and the bass player has blue ribbons on his tuning pegs. Somebody's got these vibrant green socks, and the principal second violin has this lovely shawl in blue and green. And it's just kind of improvised all over the orchestra. And you just think, oh, that's lovely. And oh, they must love doing this. It really, really creates sense between performers and audience. And then two performances they did that some of you may know about, and if you don't, go Google them and find the videos on YouTube, because they are something. They played one season Afternoon of a Faun and another year Appalachian Spring from memory, dancing the pieces while they played without a conductor for most of it. One of the dancers would beat time sometimes. Liz Lehrman, if you know that name, a real genius of a choreographer, worked with them on it. And Ann and I went thinking, you know, we love them, but musicians can't dance and they won't be able to play because they'll be dancing. But the playing was radiant and the movements were totally convincing. It really is beautiful, and it doesn't demonstrate that everybody should do that. It demonstrates that there are more ways of creating creative engagement of music than any of us have probably dreamed of. And one of the students whom I saw at a concert and recognized from the stage, I told her I had particularly loved her role, which was spinning into position to play from midway back in the stage near the center, the antique cymbals at the end of the Debussy. She said it was the greatest musical experience of her life doing that. So, two kinds of impetus for change. Big organizations want to fix the crisis, and so they think of things to do that will reach out. The National Symphony went to a big club and got 2,000 people to hear them play, and got some non-classical people, including a beatbox, human beatbox guy, and a electric cellist who played a take on the first Bach suite. But they don't tend to have a strategy when they do this. You know, 2,000 people came to that club, and now what? You know, they don't, I say that with respect to them, but they don't really know. I think the other impetus, which is deeper, less grounded, more widely distributed, and less known about, is people who in classical music who function as part of the wider culture and just, in effect, say to themselves, hey, I do that here. I go to things that are like this. So why not my concerts? Why aren't my concerts like that? And they just go and do them. One obvious locus for that is Classical Revolution, the organization of classical musicians who play in clubs, which has branches in over 30 U.S. cities and elsewhere in the world. One eloquent person in it is Sarah Mae Robinson, who is the co-director of the Classical Revolution branch in Los Angeles, who wrote a dissertation at the University of South Carolina School of Music on classical musicians who play in clubs. And as she notes, University of South Carolina Music School is very big on entrepreneurship. And this is probably why she, as a flute performance major, could get her DMA with a dissertation on classical music in clubs. But she has also written a book on playing in clubs, which is an extraordinary useful thing, I think, actually, for anybody who plays any kind of gig anywhere. But she did some guest posts for me on my blog, and in it she mentioned three reasons why you would go into a club. One of them is you need somewhere to play. No surprise that we're graduating too many people and there aren't performance opportunities for all of them, so you want to find somewhere to play. Here's a place you can play. You want to make money. I had no idea before talking to Sarah that you can make not a complete living, but not a bad part of one from doing this. And then she said she wants to play for people her own age, which I think is a big key to where a lot of people are. They just want to do things differently. So many ways that classical music has been coming lately closer to our mainstream culture. And I'm just going to make a list of one kind of limited but really, I think, transformative area where you start intersecting with other musical genres. I mentioned Mason Bates, who was also composer of the year, by the way, for the Pittsburgh Symphony, dance DJ slash symphonic composer. Renee Fleming, who has sung jazz, who recorded an album of indie rock songs called Dark Hope, who was asked by the Kennedy Center before Deborah got there if she would like to do something, and came up with a festival called American Voices, which featured classical singing, Broadway singing, gospel and R&B singing, pop singing, jazz singing, and country singing on a totally equal basis with performances and panel discussions and master classes in every one of these. My friend Lara Downs, pianist, recorded an album with the cellist Zul Bailey of American Works, and they play the Barber Cello and Piano Sonata, which is really substantial piece. And they also play some Leonard Bernstein. They play arrangements of his Broadway show tunes. Lara's latest album is an evocation of Billie Holiday, who affected her greatly growing up. She had Jed Disler, a pianist and composer, write versions of Billie Holiday songs for kind of an Earl Wilde kind of thing. I was at Jose's wonderful presentation about Earl Wilde's piano music, kind of thing he would have done. The Pacific Symphony in Orange County, California, celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Rite of Spring with a video they called The Fright of Spring, F-R-I-T-E, in which the music morphed from Stravinsky into an arrangement of Michael Jackson's Thriller. And on the film, you saw an enthusiastic young woman who was going to her first classical concert and was told that the Rite of Spring would change her life. And the musicians, played by the actual musicians, turned into zombies on stage and came after her and made her the sacrificial victim, except she woke up just before the worst was going to happen. They put that on the internet. The Seattle Symphony teamed up with old Seattle hip-hop figure Sir Mix-a-Lot, and they did a version of his song Baby Got Back about women with big butts, and they had white women jumping up on the stage to shake their butts to this song. Alan Gilbert, music director of the New York Philharmonic, has done some videos to publicize a concert performance they did of Ligeti's opera Le Grand Macabre, in which he played Guitar Hero, the rock and roll video game with the figure representing death. And he did it with such happy enthusiasm, you would never have guessed that he was the music director of one of the world's great orchestras. Ian Bostrich, the British tenor, has cited Bob Dylan as a key influence on how he sings Winterreise. The New York Philharmonic's New Year's concert a couple months ago was not Viennese bonbons. It featured Diane Reeves, truly great and marvelous jazz singer. They did Gershwin and Diane Reeves, totally American and totally contemporary. Simona Dinnerstein, as serious a pianist as you'll ever find, has recorded an album with Tift Merritt, a singer-songwriter. Hilary Hahn made an album and did a tour with Hauschka, a German keyboard artist who improvises on prepared piano, which, by the way, falls under the heading of pop music these days, because remember, pop music is the field where a group of people in Britain each year push something unlikely up the pop charts to protest the super commercial domination of the business. And one year it was John Cage's 433 as jointly recorded by 50 British pop groups, and then the recordings mixed together. So pop music extends in those directions. The Brooklyn Philharmonic, now defunct, collaborated with Mos Def, a hip-hop star from Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. They did versions of his songs arranged by Derek Bermel, an American composer who's a huge hip-hop fan. And he did a Frederick Shevsky piece with them, which calls for a spoken text. Christopher O'Reilly is kind of famous for playing arrangements of Radiohead on the piano. He and Matt Heimovitz, famous for playing in clubs, teamed up for an album and tour called Shuffle/Play, where they didn't announce the program, but they played pop arrangements and jazz arrangements and cello and piano repertoire. And the first piece, when I went to hear them, just flummoxed me. I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I'm not a cellist, I'm not an expert on the cello-piano repertoire. I'm reasonably literate. They are just playing an expert cello-piano piece by a terrific composer who is a 20th century tonal kind of neoclassical figure. Who could it possibly be? It turned out to be Chris's arrangement of some of Bernard Herrmann's music from Hitchcock's film Vertigo, turned into as legitimate a cello and piano piece as you would ever want to hear. Anderson and Rowe, dual pianists, Greg Anderson and Elizabeth Rowe. Their repertoire includes wonderful arrangements of Michael Jackson and Radiohead, and also transgressive classical things, like things that aren't the two piano repertoire, like Schubert's Erlkönig, a really dramatic performance on the video. The opening music is so has such a surge that it makes sense that on the video, Elizabeth is swept off her piano stool onto the floor. And also a wonderful Vivaldi arrangement in which one of them plays prepared piano. Maya Beiser, a new music cellist. I'm going to end the list here, but actually I'm sure I could triple its length. She's Israeli, and a few years ago made a wonderful album called Provenance, harking back to a quieter time in Israel where the Arab influence was more pronounced and more easily accepted. And so growing up, she heard Middle Eastern music of all varieties. And so she got composers to write pieces that would evoke this and finished the album with an arrangement of Led Zeppelin's song Kashmir, which sounds sort of Middle Eastern, arranged for multi-track cellos and drums. And now she's made an album which is entirely rock arrangements, and she is actually a pretty incredible rock soloist. So in 20 years, when my son has grown up, it's a big thing to ask, but if present trends continue and generational change continues as it will and must, I would expect classical music to really join contemporary culture, to become a contemporary form of art, and I will fearlessly say entertainment, because it was entertainment in past centuries, no reason it still can't be, and for God's sake, often is, for people in the audience now. Much more new music, the old music done in a meaningful contemporary context, which means really an inner awareness that we're doing it now in our way for our reasons. We are not rendering how the composers did it or why they did it or what their intentions were, which are all kind of unknowable. Or in reality, if you think of Mozart encouraging the audience at the premiere of the Paris Symphony to applaud during the music by the way he composed the piece, and many other examples of such things. Our scholarly work should show us that if we wanted to recreate what classical music was like when many of the masterworks were written, it'd be nothing like the decorum of our concert hall. And I would expect that classical music would be part of the cultural conversation, that we might even have events that I read about in a biography of Sybil Sanderson, an American soprano, very, very sexy woman who captivated Massenet, flourished in the late 19th century when she sang the title role to Manon at the Opera Comique in Paris. So many people wanted to see it that they just stopped putting on other operas and ran that four times a week. And everybody in Paris came, the intellectuals, the painters, the artists, everybody had to be there. Maybe that will happen to us again. And diversity, which I haven't spoken much of, that will break out. We won't need outreach and advocacy, and we won't need music education, because we will be right there doing things that people are thrilled to be part of. And that's a grand vision, but how do we in academia connect with it? So here's a small example of how big it is and how much we'd have to change. When I was working as a consultant at DePauw, I met quite a lot with students and faculty. And one student said he had a vision for his graduation recital. He's a tenor, happened to be African-American, which explains the third piece of his program. He wants to sing one-third classical music, one-third Broadway show tunes, and then he wants to form an a cappella singing group and do R&B for part three, and I want to say, why not? But I know why not at DePauw, because they can't teach that. No disrespect to them. They don't have people to coach them in that. And in Greencastle, Indiana, maybe it would be a real stretch for them to bring people in. But the changes are underway, and we remember that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And so I will wind up as quickly as I can. We need to change the ways that we think, and we are all doing that. And you all may be further along than I know. Maybe my whole talk is even useless, which I would really cheer if it's unnecessary. But the CMS report on undergraduate music education is a sign of change. DePauw completely upending its curriculum to stress the training of 21st century musicians. It's a sign of change. The entrepreneurship programs, something I learned about by chance from somebody who took an online course I organized in the future of classical music. She's on the piano faculty of Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario in Canada. And that piano program stresses piano playing in all genres, and you must do something creative before you can graduate. But that could be writing a pop song or arranging a pop song. Could also be realizing a figured bass. And they're very proud of their graduates who have made creative careers in music doing everything you could imagine, often in genres that are not classical. I think, by the way, they're seeing a sign of this at the Berklee School here in Boston, which is famous for teaching pop and jazz, but they began getting inquiries from classical string players who wanted to further their education but didn't only want to play classical music. So Berklee has beefed up its string department to accommodate this. I had a student at Juilliard a few years ago who was in a band that was doing very well in America's Got Talent. I would expect in the future we would not do what I think happened at Juilliard. This is treated as an impediment to him being there for his Juilliard stuff. I think we would celebrate that and celebrate it, and our PR people would be trumpeting it to the world. We would treat music as a sonic experience, not a scholarly one. We would purge formality. We would encourage musicians to move while they play the way people do in other genres, as, by the way, the Berlin Philharmonic does every single musician on that stage, if you've ever seen it. Most amazing thing, they are putting their bodies into it, the bass players dancing with their basses. I saw them in New York a few years ago. I come out and I see a friend of mine who plays in the New York Philharmonic, and he comes running over. Did you see how they move? I'd be reprimanded if I moved that way. And I think this is not a small part of why the sound the Berlin Philharmonic has goes so deep into the earth, because their bodies are into it. And we would encourage a creative approach to the old repertoire, which is a long story. But when I taught at Eastman, one of my students, a pianist, came and said, "What do you think of this? I'd like to play the Brahms F minor sonata with the movements in reverse order, and my teacher won't let me." Well, I'm not surprised that the teacher wouldn't, but I think in our future we would just say, "Well, try it and let's see." I have no idea, by the way, if that would work or not, but she wanted to. A guy named Dan Tepfer, a jazz pianist, has recorded the Goldberg Variations. And instead of repeating the variations, as of course many pianists don't do anyway, he improvises on them all. With, if you listen very carefully, his respect for the four cadences that occur in each variation and in the aria is really notable, but it happens very fast. Stuart Goodyear, a pianist friend of mine, had the vision of playing all the Beethoven piano sonatas in a single day marathon, and he finally has done it a few times. And then Long Long, who plays in ways that many people just roll their eyes at, but I think with great integrity. When I saw him do a program that involved three Mozart sonatas, at times he would find something in the Mozart sonata that he would linger over, and you'd think he was in the ethereal parts of the slow movement of Opus 111. And some people say, that's not Mozart. But I noticed that he scrupulously followed the flow of the sonata form. And I thought it was remarkable how true he was to the music while totally reinventing it. We can change what we teach. I don't think we teach the classical repertoire enough. I have Juilliard students who don't really know anything besides the repertoire from their own instruments. I even had a group, I played for them, I wanted to open their minds. The wonderful 1959 Sir Thomas Beecham recording of Messiah with a huge, huge, huge orchestra full of brass and percussion. I played them the Hallelujah Chorus, and I was astonished to learn that many of them, Juilliard graduate students, didn't know that that's not how you're supposed to perform Baroque music, or that it was Baroque music, and many of them had never heard the Hallelujah Chorus. I think we have some time, some stuff to make up in our own backyard. And I think we need to teach the non-classical repertoire. My students have only the most fragmentary knowledge of Charlie Parker, Duke Ellington, Robert Johnson, James Brown, Joni Mitchell, Public Enemy, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, or Latin music or world music. Somehow this has to be part of their musical world so that they have musical literacy across the board. Of course, entrepreneurship, which is a good thing. So that's happening. I do think it'd be wonderful if we encouraged our musicians, student musicians, to develop fan bases on the university campus, outside the school in the community. I dream of Juilliard students who give recitals and 150 people from around the city come of their own age. Their fan base whom they've cultivated online and social media and going around and giving concerts. I don't think it's impossible. We need to change how we teach music history so it's not the history of compositional trends. We learn how the composers make a living, which is often entrepreneurial. And my students all think they had patrons, which kind of puts classical music in our age of donated money. But no, they had employers. Prince Esterhazy was not Haydn's patron. He was Haydn's boss. And the idea that you would write music for practical use and find a way to make money, this would actually help people now, and they should know that that's part of our past. We should teach the history of reception, how the audience talked during the music and applauded the moment it heard something it liked. And just get some perspective on past musics, that the notion of classical music only emerged at the beginning of the 19th century as we know it today, anything like we know it today. That Rossini was far and away the most popular composer in Europe in the first half of the 19th century. We may prefer to talk about Beethoven, but Rossini was the man, far as fame in the audience went. And Beethoven thought the Barbara of Seville was a pretty hot opera, though when in a famous meeting he was told that Rossini was in Vienna premiering a serious opera, he just broke out laughing and said, he can't write that stuff. Anyway, great stories. And we should change how we teach theory and analysis. So we're teaching the analysis of other kinds of music, jazz, pop, and non-Western, which requires different concepts, different vocabulary. And the goal is to deepen understanding of the art of music by showing how different kinds of music work, and also to show the validity of other kinds of music and fight the idea that classical music is superior because it has its well-known complexities. Other musics have their own kinds of complexities. I remember a wonderful quote from Robert Palmer, pop music critic and deep historian of the blues, who said, if you wanted primitive music, listen to Mozart, because the beat wasn't inflected and the tone quality was very simple and didn't vary very much. I say we have to agree with that, but the concept should be out there. And then a big change in how we relate to those outside us, which is a way we could really prove our value by music departments and schools going out on their campuses, in their communities, and doing things that people will care about. So at Baldwin Wallace University in Missouri, I believe, they have a Bach festival that the school officially sponsors. So some of the students started a Beatles festival that runs alongside the Bach festival, and the music students and other people, like drama students, perform Beatles songs. And I remember seeing a video where the trumpet faculty principal member played the trumpet solo in Penny Lane and really killed it. And this has been a big thing on campus, and the school has totally embraced it as a great thing to do and a great contribution to the school as well as the campus. And finally, DePauw, not only a new curriculum, but The visionary dean there, Mark McCoy, was asked why there wasn't closer contact between the liberal arts campus and the School of Music. And he said, well, let's make it happen. And he created a festival where every year, for one full day, School of Music students in large and small ensembles play at the liberal arts campus. And apparently this has ramped up attendance at School of Music concerts. The DePaul School of Music has taken over the music instruction at Greencastle's middle school. So students and faculty are now teaching the middle school students music, which, if you want to prove your value to the community, you have just done it in spades. Because farming is the biggest industry there. They've done extensive outreach to farmers with great success, culminating at the end of last year with a concert that many, many people attended, where local people performed music and local people read poetry, and videos were shown about the local area, and the DePaul Orchestra and Chorus did a Copland piece, and I can't remember what. It wasn't something I knew about, and farmers came. And now they've opened a storefront in Greencastle where they can teach, where they can do performances, where they can sell tickets to concerts. Not a complete solution. Don't know where it's going to go in the future, but certainly is getting out there and showing you have some value. So, quickly now to really end. These are big changes. I think they're necessary. I think they will happen. But to end quietly, things I would like to think anyone could do. Make all of this a topic of discussion wherever you are. You know, I may teach my course at Juilliard, but this is not a topic of discussion through the school. What's happening? Where is classical music going? Even though Juilliard can no longer raise enough money to stay in business and is embarked, though they don't like to say this in public, on profit-making enterprises in order to make up the nut. So they know things are changing. They know it, and in other ways too. But I think the discussion should be encouraged, and the ferment will lead to changes, I think, that we can't even anticipate. Set up a diversity challenge. Ask people to really solve the question, what do you do for Black History Month in classical music? Now, the standard answer that I've gotten is you perform music by Black composers. I don't think so. These aren't composers you actually care about, to be brutally honest. And they're not composers the African American community really cares about. And you're not going to do them again until maybe Black History Month rolls around again. And the Black community sees through that in a moment. So when I was doing a workshop for the League of American Orchestras on how things could change, I brought this up as a problem and suggested one approach. There's a wonderful book by Elaine Mack, Black Classical Music in Philadelphia. It's an oral history. The book is out of print, and I noticed that a used copy goes for $500 through Amazon's sellers. But anyway, what emerges is that there was a vibrant classical music culture in the African-American community in Philadelphia, basically before World War II. And I think this is probably true in many places. So one could, as a classical music institution, do that study in various ways wherever you are. Think of things to do outside the classroom. At the University of Maryland, in the wake of my being there, but not through anything I directly did, which is kind of wonderful, the students decided to organize their living spaces, their dorms and fraternities, to get people to come to the orchestra concerts. And I only discovered this the year after I was there, when I went to a concert, and instead of the hall being half full, which would be about 500 people, of nice, quiet classical music lovers my age, it was packed with students. And that was because the students had gone out and just organized people to come. And I think some version of that can probably be done anywhere. So these are small things, but in a time of change, a little spark can light a huge fire. So I would say, even if you can't think how to make something huge happen and it seems impossible for everything to just change, do something. And I think the results will be pretty terrific. Thanks.